Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Yesterday, Genko got us started with the story of Jigong, who was this nun who lived in the 1600s. And when we left off yesterday, she had received her scepter, the symbol of transmission, which, as Joe Biden would say, is a big effing deal. It's to have a woman be fully transmitted, to be able to teach and be able to make disciples herself and pass the lineage on in that way. Her teacher, Shi Qi, had a lot of disciples, and only made a handful of transmitted teachers, including this woman, which didn't make all of the disciples happy, all of the guys. The number of them wondered what's up with this. And they were skeptical and kind of annoyed, and the record says until they came around and realized how skilled she really was as a teacher. As Genko said, things were really changing in these days in China. I got to tell you, I was an American studies major in college, and I realized when I just started looking at China the last couple of years. I'm 52, maybe. And I've realized, America's so much easier than China. Because the recorded history of America is much, much shorter. Thousands of years of people taking very detailed notes in China. So now I have just a little bit of time left to really get as much as I can about China. I will not bore you with all of it now. But I will say that in the Ming Dynasty, which was just ending around in the 1600s here, it was falling apart and it was a time of real violent and also just change altogether. Conventions were changing. People felt uneasy. And it was also, it gave a chance. That kind of chaos was an opportunity for women. Women and men could leave the home and become monks or nuns more easily. It was more acceptable to do that in this time of loosening conventions and change. And there were more chances for women to become teachers because of this instability, because women were being educated as never before. So you had a kind of a... And they were also writing, and they were getting published. The printing press had arrived, and it meant that women's voices were heard in a way that they had never been heard before. There was one volume they mentioned which has the poems of 1,000 women in it. How do you get that many? 1,500 poems in a book that was disseminated. And also Zen was changing at this time. There was a revival of Rinzai Zen in particular. And looking back to Rinzai, looking back to a time when things were... looking back to a wilder Zen. Change and chaos has its upside. Look back to a wilder Zen which was more intuitive, more poetic, and more spontaneous than it had been before. So this was a time in which, yeah, so it gave, it, things were loosening. And I just want to mention, I want to give a tip of the hat to an old master that I'd never heard of before. This had happened before, this kind of women blossoming of women teachers, once before in the Song Dynasty in the 1100s. And that's thanks to the most influential Zen master of that time. Some people say the most influential of the whole Song Dynasty, which came after the glorious Tang. I won't get into all the dates. But Dai Hai, Dahai, D-A-H-A-I, Dahai Zonggao. I'd never heard of him before, but he broke things open for women in a way that had never been. He was the first one to have women successors. And so that was the first time that a lineage hold, there was a women's lineage holder, a kind of a women's line. Also, men weren't needed for, they changed the rules in the song, and men weren't needed to be even at an ordination, whereas they were before in the old rules. So that that allowed women to come into their own. And at this time in the 1600s, they looked back to those times. That's what happens. They said, oh, remember Dahai? He did it. Because there was a lot of pushback to this idea of women as teachers. But they said, oh, remember Dahai? He did it. And he was a great master. Okay, so Jing Dong was after her, so she has her great awakening and stamp and scepter, and what does she do? She goes to hermitage. She goes back to her parents' place by their graves, and she builds a little hermitage there, and she stays there for 9 years right after she gets the scepter. Just practicing Zazen, very small, very quiet life. And she even, it's kind of ascetic. She does ascetic practice. She doesn't take much food for long periods of time. So she really must have gotten to know silence deeply during this time. And then, 9 years pass, it's 1647, I think that makes her about 50. And she moves in briefly to the Delighting in Mountains convent, assuming she's going to spend the rest of her days there. And something happens. She's asked by a group of lay practitioners if she'll come and take over a little budding convent that they started. This that they just named the Lion Subduing Cloister. So it's owned by Madame Li, who's in the Dong family. The Dong family in that area were great supporters of Buddhism. Mostly Pure Land, but also some Chan. And Madame Li built this little cloister for her only daughter after her husband died when the daughter was young, and the daughter was very shy. She'll come back later. She was very shy and retiring. And so she built a kind of a cloister for her. She always wanted to be a nun. And Madame Li, she dies, and soon after, one of the Dong family members, Man, decides to put up more buildings and open it up to the public. And so, Jing Gong was asked to come and take that over. And she accepts. She says, I think of myself as ignorant and had planned to live a life of seclusion, but I want to repay in part the nourishment I got from my teacher. So she wants to pay it forward, so she decides to take this job. And many were skeptical that it was going to work out. Here she's just come off 9 years of solo retreat. How's she going to do in this kind of a job? She didn't have, her resume didn't look great. But she proved herself to be a strong and charismatic leader and gained a reputation as a real serious and profound meditation teacher, master. And it wasn't long before there were, it says, 100 nuns living in her community. Then they came from far away, having heard about her. And they were, it says, undeterred by the small and cramped quarters. And Madame Lee's daughter that I mentioned, the shy one, she became Jing Gong's first official disciple. And over time, and they build up the monastery, and over time it becomes one of the 10 scenic sites in that region of China. She is, I found this interesting, she's sought out by not only women but also men for advice. And we have 21 letters of her advice, and 8 of those letters were to men. One of her lay followers was held in high esteem by the Empress of China. This woman's son describes Jing Gong as grave and dignified, simple and straightforward. And she met with monks too, not only lay people. There was, some monks came to her asking, could you inscribe a copy of the Lotus Sutra that one of the monks had? In the old days, they would use their own blood and mix it with ink and write out the whole Lotus Sutra. Our little Lotus Sutra that we chant, many of you haven't even chanted that. That's only one chapter, that whole 13-page thing. So the Lotus Sutra is very long. And they would write it out in their own blood. And she says, modestly, I'm really not up to the task of doing something like that. But they insist, so she writes, where does the blood come from? Who is the one who copied out the sutra? Answer this and you will be able to break open the burning house. That's a reference to the Lotus, story in the Lotus Sutra. And allow the true method to reveal itself. If the layman wants to truly experience this, then the most fitting thing would be to consign this copy of the sutra to the flames so that not a single character remains. Then you will be happy. So after saying, oh no, I'm not up to that task, she comes out with that. She's obviously a confident teacher at this point. And so according to her disciple who writes her history, men of letters came and to debate her, and they'd have to sheathe their swords and put away their knives because they were chastened. They became tongue-tied. And noblemen would come, and they left humble. At this time, the literati was fascinated by Zen texts, and she just saw that as a sign of, not of revival, but of degeneration. She encouraged her nuns not to yammer on about emptiness or spread the baseless information simply to amuse oneself or others. She was a... She was an imposing character. And she attracted lots of lay donors, enough that she could... I found this a nice, sweet detail, that she shared resources and money with other organizations and with the poor. And later in life, she became a rock star. She was, they say, you know, if she was to arrive in a certain town that 1,000 people would gather, you know, asking her for teaching. And we'll leave it there. Her story for today. Let's get to the poems. These are two of her poems. They're a couple from a series about everyday objects. I forget the other ones in the series, but anyway, here we've got an alms bowl and a meditation cushion. You know, I don't know that her poems are deathless from my point of view, but they are a window into her world, into Zhigong's world. And I think of a perfectly good guide to us doing this practice, to us doing this retreat right now. Let's look at the alms bowl. How elegant it is. I'm imagining this alms bowl. I don't know what it looked like, really. It was probably not used for begging out in the streets, because that was not cool in China in those days. The rich donors, the donor class, did not like them walking around knocking on doors. So they just did their practice as best they could, and people, if you do practice well, then people support it. And that's the way they worked it. But so I imagine this bowl, maybe that was her eating bowl, you know, reading this poem, her everyday eating bowl. And probably somewhat rustic, that's the way I picture it, worn down, wooden, I suppose. But for her, it's perfect. It's perfectly elegant. Doesn't even have a leak in it. Or a hole. Pretty good. I just came back from Japan, as most of you know. And there, I just love the aesthetic, the wabi-sabi aesthetic of things that are old and worn and taken care of and beautiful. All the more beautiful because they're imperfect, because they're worn, because they're a little cracked. That wabi-sabi, by the way, comes from China, kind of originally, that aesthetic, so it's not just in Japan. And I think it calls into question our reflexive ideas about imperfection, that kind of aesthetic. These beautiful placards, which were just so sort of taken care of, but the ink was fading on the old wood. Statues, these little arhats, cute little arhats, which are just made more beautiful, far more beautiful because of all the moss growing on them. Sometimes half obscuring these trees that are propped up, these trees that are just ready to fall down. And they're propped up with these wooden props, taken care of in their old age. And Genko mentioned just before the retreat, we were talking about that very thing, that this tea bowl that she knew that was cracked, and the crack was filled with gold, you know? Not something so that you see it, so that you honor that crack. The crack is the beautiful part. As Lena Cohen says, that there is a crack in everything that's had a light gets in it. And that's a Zen. That has a Zen feeling to it. See, not as much, and it's particular to Zen. I found over there anyway. The Pure Land temples, at least, you know, they were shiny. and beautifully taken care of. I don't mean to say that it's exactly like this, because everything's kind of a mix, but you definitely have that warm feeling in Zen places. And I think when we do our Zazen, we have to, in order to do Zazen, really do Zazen, we have to accept our imperfections. We can't just go straight there and ignore our mistakes and imperfections. I really think we have to, at some point, and as we go, accept our brokenness in order to really get quiet. It's part of our practice. We have to leave our lives just to come here and to sit quietly. We have to leave our lives unimproved, at least for a time, and leave ourselves imperfect just as we are. And so I think this acceptance is a real important part of our practice, this self-acceptance. We've got many problems. Everybody here does. And many loose ends. All kinds of things that are pulling us to, save them, improve them. We have so many messes and mistakes that we have to just put down, but not shove away, but put down in a way that we can say, okay, that's me. I am sitting in the middle of a mess, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to sit here with this crack. And honor it, even. Made of gold. Okay. That will help us get quiet. That kind of acceptance. And I think if we can do that, then we can realize that there really is a perfection, a deeper perfection, that is in every moment that we can't find unless we give up trying to perfect our lives in the regular way that we do. We have to drop that. We have to let that go. It's hard. I want to hold on to that, to that feeling of wanting to improve, wanting to get better. So Jigong here says, when thirsty I drink, when hungry I eat. That's a reference to Rinzai. I won't get into, not leaving a crumb. I understand that once washed, nothing more needs to be done. That's a reference. There's lots of these references in here. I'm not going to go into all of them, but this one I will. Joshu's, Mumukan number 7, Joshu's bowls. Monk comes to Joshu, says, Master, please teach me. Joshu says, have you eaten your breakfast? And the monk says, yes. And Joshu says, clean the bowls. And the monk is enlightened. Enlightenment was easier in those days. on the one hand, that means to once your work is done, you can really be empty. Just do your work and then you're empty. And on the other hand, also, you are the bowl. And you really have to clean that out. Clean that bowl out completely. And so I see Jigong as, clean out her bowl. That's what she did for those 9 years. She cleaned out that bowl. That was not that wooden bowl. It was not a beautiful, perfect bowl, but she cleaned it out. And then she says, yeah, and then once you've cleaned it out, you can see that bowl, you see, as just right, with all of its imperfections. Just right. And that doesn't show up until the bowl is clean. Cleaned out. And then she says, why do so many people want to put a handle on this bowl? You know, so many lost souls. I like that image a lot. It comes up also in other places too, putting a handle on a bowl. How many dumb ideas do we have about improving ourselves? You know, well, let's put a handle on this bowl. You don't need a handle on the bowl. The bowl's fine, just like it is. But we come up with these ideas to improve ourselves. Rinzai says, why do you keep putting a head on top of you, the one you already have? It's this similar feeling. And I do think we owe it to ourselves to, I just want to put it, to complicate matters, to improve ourselves. But realizing an empty bowl gives us a chance to improve ourselves with fewer dumb ideas. With fewer just pasting on this, that, and the other, just taking something, and yeah, okay, I'll take that, I'll want that, I'll try that. Empty the bowl, and then things become clearer. We accept ourselves, and we can move on in a way that I think truly improves our lives and the lives of others. Let's look at the meditation cushion. So just another common object that she has around the house. This meditation cushion, she says, you know, you have that and you're completely protected. It's all you need. And there's no magic here, I don't think. There is magic in Buddhism and in Zen. You know, the Heart Sutra, that was many people saw that as a kind of protection device. You know, chant just chant the Heart Sutra. Max told me when I go to Japan, Kyoto, he said, if you get in trouble, just chant the Heart Sutra. Everybody will help you. I didn't have to. Everybody was helpful anyway. But it's good to know. Good to have it in your back pocket. That's a good reason to memorize the Heart Sutra in the old Sino-Japanese, just in case you find yourself in Japan or China in a bind. But in this case, there's no magic. It's just... Here's the thing. When you're sitting on your meditation cushion, you're okay. It's okay. Heaven and earth are crumbling. It's okay. This aspect of you always, this aspect that knows that it's okay, it's a funny kind of protection. It's not a usual kind of protection. But this aspect that knows that you're okay always exists. It's always with you. That knows that the world is okay in its imperfection. And even though we can't feel it all the time, Zen tells us we always have access to it. We always have that. We have that deep, old knowledge. And in a retreat like this, we coax it to the fore, that feeling of it's okay. We're a mess, and it's okay. And the meditation cushion, in this case, represents that aspect. And so does this Zendo. It represents that aspect of ourselves that is protected in that way. We keep it clean and quiet, and it accepts you. It accepts, you know, everybody, all kinds of different people. And no matter how many times you've messed up, no matter what kind of criminal background you have, the big temples in Kyoto, all the temples have a temple gate. And the big temples in Kyoto have a really big gate. I mean, it's massive. It's like the biggest thing around. Tall, tall, big gate. And you, up above the gate, at the top level, there they put the Buddha with all of his arhats. And sometimes there's 18 of them, with the 18 kind of traditions. Yeah, and but they just represent the 500, you know, that there really are. And they're all different. Some of them laughing, some of them crying, some of them joking around, some of them playing with animals. They're all different. They represent all of the differentiation, all of the different sorts of people that practice, that come to this practice. And you walk in underneath all of them. They're all right there, right at the gate, welcoming you. Yeah, you're one of us. And then you go in, and you get the beautiful, quiet space. You get that beautiful garden. And that's something that we all share inside those gates. That's something that we all share. And that this is something that we all share. We all share this silent aspect. And she says, it's not only that heaven and earth may crumble or collapse, but also sacred titles and worldly fame, they just fade away in the sitting. So we just become a person of no rank, as Rinzai says, when we're sitting. So all of our medals, all of our mess-ups, all of our collapses, and all of our medals, all of our successes, all of good and all of bad are gone in this moment. They don't apply here. So forget about them. Or, another way to say the same thing is that all of our messes, all of our honors, all good, all bad is right here. Is accepted, is done, is finished because it's here. Everything is held in this one moment. Ah, okay. And Jingang says, all the worlds, the Chiliocosm, that's a word, that's a very specific Buddhist word, that means everything. All the worlds, all the millions of Buddhist worlds, everything is held in the tip of a feather. Everything is held in the footfall, as we're doing Kenyan, in the song of a bird. So today, please do your best to accept your imperfection, your incompleteness, your troubles. Accept them in
in the same way that this space accepts them, as your cushion accepts them. And let's try to find the peace that is with us all, always.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.